Let's turn in our Bibles to Genesis 23. So it's a couple of weeks since I preached in the evening. If you remember from our last sermon, we were at the end of chapter 22. And there we find something of a mini genealogy related to Abraham's brother Nahor. And we have a list there of Nahor's children and his grandchildren. Nahor was still living in Ur of the Chaldeans. And of particular significance in that genealogy is verse 23, where we are told that Bethuel begot Rebekah. It may seem odd to just find this little genealogy in the narrative of Abraham's life. But the backdrop, of course, is for the next stage of the covenant promise to be fulfilled. Isaac had to have a wife, and Isaac had to have a children. And Isaac's wife could not just be taken from among the Canaanites. She had to belong within the Messianic line. So going back to Abraham's father, Terah. So where would a bride be found among the Canaanites? Now, later on, Gentiles were added into the Messianic line further on, but initially amongst the patriarchs, so Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their wives, they all descended from Terah. Well, where was such a woman to come from? And to add to this, Isaac was no spring chicken when it came to marriage. He was roughly in his mid-30s, and that's quite old back then, to be getting married or not to have a wife. And time is going on. And Abraham and Sarah, there's a sense in which it's deja vu. They waited years and years and years for the arrival of Isaac. They prayed and sought the Lord, and the years rolled on. And once again, they are praying and they are waiting. They are praying and they are waiting. Where will this woman come from? But they can't just, you know, find a lady from among the Canaanites. She doesn't fit the bill according to the purposes of God. And then out of the blue, one day unexpectedly, a stranger rides up on his camel to Abraham's tent. He gets off and he refreshes himself and washes his face and has a drink, and he delivers this news from Nahor's family, this little genealogy. And Abraham would have understood the significance of what we call verse 23. Bethuel begot Rebekah. Abraham knew that he had been sent by God, and this was a message given by God. In a list comprising of males, there is a girl mentioned, a female. She was the one who would be the bride. 1,600 kilometers away, across the Arabian Peninsula, God had prepared someone for Isaac and for the covenant promise to enter into its next stage. And we made some application from this in terms of the mysterious, supernatural, sovereign working of God. He's working in ways that we cannot see, and he's pulling all things together for his own will and purpose. Abraham had no knowledge, Isaac had no knowledge, and Sarah no knowledge of where this woman would come from, but God was at work. God will fulfill his own purposes. He always does. God will bring his plan to fruition. And so they are the things that we considered some weeks ago now, a couple of weeks ago, at the end of chapter 22. Well, and we'll look at this further in chapter 24. Isaac and Rebekah, we'll touch on a little bit then. But this evening then we come to chapter 23. And what I intend to do is I'll read the chapter as I go through the sermon. We're taking a big chunk this evening. We're taking the whole of the chapter. I think it's just best to look at it in one hit. And so we'll make our way through the whole of the chapter and read it as we go. This chapter touches on two things. Verses 1 and 2, the death of Sarah, and then from verse 3 to the end, verse 20, the burial of Sarah. And so we'll consider those issues this evening. Let's note then firstly the death of Sarah, verses 1 and 2. Excuse me. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. So Abraham had lived considerable time in the southern part of Canaan, as we know, around Beersheba, after Isaac was born. And we find now when Sarah dies, he's back in the region that he previously lived in, going up north. So Hebron is west of the Dead Sea, about sort of halfway along the Dead Sea, going west. And Sarah died at the ripe old age of 127. That means Abraham was 137 and Isaac was 37. And it seems that as women get older, they like to keep their age under wraps. I'm not so sure that that's true of younger women, but certainly as women get older, they like to sort of be discreet with their age. But we know how old Sarah was when she died. We know how old Sarah was when she was called to go to the promised land. We know how old she was when she gave birth to Isaac. So all of these things have been recorded for us to sit within a time frame. And God is concerned to frame the narrative in terms of time, place, people, and events. So we don't have a wishy-washy kind of faith without any substance. We're able to see things progress. We're able to see people's lives unfold, events taking place. We're able to see regions and towns and the ages of people. And it's particularly the case with this family. So pivotal are they in the purposes of God. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, Sarah is the only woman in the Bible whose age at the time of her death has been recorded for us. Now, this means as we look at these ages and Sarah dying when she's 127, this is saying to us that Sarah had spent approximately half of her life as a believer. Half of her life as a believer. When the word of the Lord came to Abraham to go on this great journey to the land of promise, Sarah was 65 years of age. And we know that it was not just a physical journey, but it was a journey of faith. She, along with her husband, believed and trusted in the Lord to provide and to protect and to fulfill the promises that he had made. And the book of Hebrews presents her to us as an example of faith. Now, we know through what we've read and what we've been considering now over a number of months that both Abraham and Sarah, as examples of faith, they had their ups and downs in life. They had their struggles. And as we're considering Sarah this morning, we know that her faith was not always as healthy and as strong and as robust as it could have been. Nevertheless, God upheld her and she persevered. And we are told in the book of Hebrews that God strengthened her through faith that she might conceive. Because the conception of Isaac was both natural and unnatural. It was natural in the sense that she was with her husband Abraham, and they were intimate and she conceived, but she was past the age of bearing children. She was enabled to conceive Isaac. Sarah was a godly woman. Sarah came to realize her mistake concerning Hagar and Ishmael. And Sarah, unlike her husband, came to see that Hagar and Ishmael had no place in the covenant family and they had to be removed. And of course, this was a deeply grievous thing for Abraham. No doubt he had affection for Hagar. He took her in as his wife and he loved his son Ishmael. But Sarah saw things as they were and she insisted that they be removed, that they had no place in the family, and God confirmed to Abraham that this was the case and he must listen to his wife, and they had to be sent out. So she was a godly woman. She lived a long life of faith. But as it is with everybody, the clock ran down. She had her allotted time, her 70, and then the bell tolled for Sarah. And there is quite some detail here about her death and burial. And the scriptures never skip over the issue of death. And so many of God's saints, their deaths are recorded for us, the manner in which they died and how they were gathered up with their people. In the Bible, we should say, God exhorts us not only to think about the pleasant things in life, you know, the birth of little children and enjoying life and living life. And of course we think about those things, but God would have us to think about death. It is better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting, says Solomon in Ecclesiastes. And of course what he means is it's better to go to a funeral than to a wedding. A wedding is lovely, and we've had several of them, and God willing, we've got some more coming up, and we love weddings and we love the birth of children. They're wonderful times of celebration and rejoicing in the goodness of God. But of course, a funeral is a very somber time in which we are confronted with the reality of death, that our time in this world must come to an end, and there is benefit for us to reflect upon our mortality, the fragility and the uncertainty of life. Uncertainty in the sense we don't know that we are or when we are going to go, but certainty in the sense that it will happen. We will die unless the Lord Jesus Christ returns first. And so we ought to think about death, but the approach to this is very much the opposite in secular society. In the early 1970s, there was a book published by the philosopher Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death. And he wrote about the way people seem to live without any concept that we're going to die. I want to say without any concept. They push it to the subconscious, refusing to think about it. And he described it as a kind of survival mechanism, just as people, you know, won't go to a place of danger or they're alerted to danger and they withdraw. It's like there is a withdrawal mechanism within human beings that does not want to contemplate death. And many people will go to the end almost as though they're going to live here forever. How many people die worried about their money and still thinking about their status and all of these kinds of things as though they've got forever? So people refuse to get to grips with the fact that life is short. And it's like that man in the parable who just kept building his barns and building his barns as though he would be here for 1,000,000 years. The denial of death, Ernest Becker, as though our creativity and our achievements and our money and our reputation will remain forever, and they don't. Now, it's quite common in funerals today, the word death not even to be mentioned, let alone the seriousness of death. The onus in many funerals today is on celebrating life. We're here to celebrate grandpa's life and to remember the good times. And I'm not suggesting that that is a bad thing, but there is this complete avoidance of the seriousness of what death is. What you find is that people speak of passing. They're just passing away. It's another chapter. There's a new chapter that's opened for them. They pass rather than die. Pass on to what? In a sense, they're not wrong, but into what do people pass? Think of the words of Job in Job chapter 14, and these words are actually put together in the Book of Common Prayer for ministers to use at the burial of the deceased. And this idea, when someone dies, we let the balloons go or we let some birds out of a cage and we just think about the good times and they live on in our memory and we rejoice and celebrate. Listen to the words of Job concerning death. Chapter 14, verses 1 to 10. There is a completely different approach. Job 14, 1 to 10. Man who is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. Do you open your eyes on such a one and bring me to judgment with yourself? Who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? No one. Since his days are determined, the number of his months is with you. You have appointed his limits so that he cannot pass. Look away from him that he may rest, till like a hired man he finishes his day. For there is hope for a tree if it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its tender shoots will not cease. Though its root may grow old in the earth, and its stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth its branches like a plant. But man dies and is laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last, and where is he? And it goes on, and Job's point is this. There is no coming back. You cut down a tree just to a stump, and with a little bit of water, it'll continue to spring forth with life. Little saplings will grow out of it. Job says, even at the smell of water, new life will come. But that is not the case with man. Cut down a tree, it continues. Cut down a man, and that is the end in terms of this life. It's not the end, of course, in the ultimate sense. A human being steps into that eternal, spiritual, unseen realm. And we can say that there is another chapter, and people do pass from one realm to another. But the question that we face is this: into what kind of realm do people step? Into what kind of dimension do they enter? Man's life in terms of the present dominion comes to an end. That is it. He is done. She is done. It is finished. Before we come to Abraham's response and look at how Abraham responded to the death of his dear wife, let's just momentarily give some thought to the place of God in this scenario. God determined the time and the manner of Sarah's death. He determined the time and the place and the parents to whom Sarah was born, as he does with every individual. She lived to a ripe old age, not everybody does. God determines all the days of our lives, according to the psalmist in Psalm 139. Even before we are made, God has a record of the days that he has prepared for us that we might walk in them. So the circumstances, the time, the parents to whom we are born is determined by God. You live in this country. You have the parents that you do. You live in the 21st century, determined by God. He has prepared days in advance for you, including your demise. God has already determined the time and the means through which you will depart. And so it was for Sarah. Sarah's death did not take him by surprise. You know that. That's stating the obvious. But nor did God treat it in a glib, offhand kind of way. Even though he is the sovereign, the potentate, the king, he doesn't look at this scenario and kind of say to himself, well, you know, she had a full life. It is what it is. Everybody has to go. The scriptures tell us that God looks at the death of his saints with great tenderness. Psalm 116, verse 15. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. And so it was with Sarah. So it is with all of God's people. And God places great value on the death of his people because he places great value on the life of his people. Their lives are important. He loves them. And he's not indifferent to the difficulties associated with death. and an aging woman leaving this world and leaving her husband and the grief that came upon Abraham. God is not indifferent to these things. There is a tenderness and a compassion when it comes to his people. I said to you before that she'd spent a long time as a believer, over six decades, and her faithfulness and her hard work and the work as a mother and as a wife and the sacrifices she made and the perseverance and all of those things are acknowledged by the Lord. The scriptures tell us that he bottles the tears of those whom he loves. Our griefs and our struggles and the difficulties of life are not lost on him. And he looks upon the end, the struggles associated with death, with great sympathy and love. Precious in the sight of God is the death of his sons. I'm always reminded of this verse when I think back to a moment when I went to Rockdale Christian Books. I used to love going to Rockdale Christian Books when it was open. I used to like going there to chat to the volunteer workers that were there and the guy that ran the bookshop, and it doesn't exist now. He runs it from the Southern Highlands, but there was this guy that used to work there, and he was a big guy, and he was a kind of awkward fellow and very, very friendly, and he loved to discuss things, and he'd sort of wander around chatting to people, and you get the sense that he'd had a difficult life. He wasn't married, and I went in one day to find out that he died, and he was only like 40 or something like that. And there was another volunteer who died shortly before him, and they had a picture of the first guy that had died on the wall, and they were going to put a picture up of this guy. And I couldn't help at the time but think of Psalm 116 and verse 15 and how God feels about the death of his people. To the world around, it meant nothing. His life meant nothing. His death meant nothing. People weren't going to pour into the cemetery. Maybe there was just a little handful of people. To the best of my knowledge, he had no immediate family. It meant nothing in the eyes of the world, but to God, he was precious. His life and his death were precious. But then there is Abraham. He had been married to Sarah for a very, very long time. They had been through so much together, so much of it unique. They were a unique family with the calling of God upon their lives. You know, they knew each other inside and out. The quirkiness, the faults, the strengths, the weaknesses, all of those things that make us who we are, the idiosyncrasies, they knew each other inside and out. They were married for over 100 years. How did Abraham feel about this, his wife taken away through death? Verse 2, Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, as you are aware, Paul says to the Thessalonians that we don't grieve as the unconverted grieve. They grieve as without hope. Believers have hope, but we still grieve. Jesus wept over Lazarus. I have heard some of the most appalling arguments with regards to the tears of Jesus, almost excusing or trying to get away from any sense of the emotional life over the death of his friend. And such an approach just does violence to the text. Jesus wept over one who had died because he loved him. Death is a terrible, terrible thing. You know, when Stephen was martyred, we are told that the early Christians made great lamentation over him. Their friend was gone, cruelly put to death at the hands of the ungodly. Now, we know for the dead in Christ, they will rise again. We know that they go to be with the Lord, but death, by virtue of what it is still an enemy. It is a terrible thing, death. Death is the consequence of sin. Yes, it ushers us into the presence of Christ, and that is good, but death is the consequence of sin. It is evidence of the curse. Death is a thief. It robs people of their life. Life is precious. It is the gift of God. It robs people of relationship. Abraham suddenly finds himself without his wife. Perhaps he knew it was coming. She was getting older and frailer and she wasn't well, and he knew that her time was coming to an end. But of course, once it happens, it is final. And there's something about that. There's something confronting when it finally happens. The relationship is over. Death is a thief. It robs people of life. It robs people of dignity. It robs people of relationship. You know, death is unnatural. We were not made to die. And death is a separation of soul and body. And that is to exist in an unnatural state. And so the theologians refer to the deceased, those who have gone to be with the Lord, and those who are in that dark and terrible place, the theologians refer to that as the intermediate state. It's not final. And those who are deceased exist in an unnatural condition, the separation of the soul and body. And then at the end, at the resurrection, soul and body will be joined together, and that's the way it's meant to be. Death is unnatural. And as I've said, death is final. It is the end in terms of this life. I don't grieve over my parents who are both deceased, but I had a good relationship with them, but I do miss them from time to time. And I think, you know, they never got to saw Cameron grow up, and my mum only saw the other two when they were very little. You know, wouldn't it be a nice thing on one level for them to be a part of the family? I rejoice that they're with the Lord, but in terms of my life now, in the presence of my children, sometimes it would be nice to have them around. I don't know if we ever think about this, but, you know, there are some of us here who will become widows. Some of you ladies will become widows. Some of us men will become widowers. We will lose our parents. I've lost mine. Some of you have lost some of your parents or lost all of them. And I say this almost, God forbid, some of us may lose our children. Like Abraham, we will mourn and weep. But as we shall see with Abraham, the mourning came to an end. Abraham married again, and Abraham had more children. Do you know, for many people, the pain of loss, and I think particularly when it comes to a spouse or children, that pain never fully goes. It's different when parents die, because that's what we expect. You know, the saying always is, we expect to bury our parents, we don't expect to bury our children. You think of marriages where people have been married for 60 years and then it comes to an end. And the wife is no longer there. The husband is no longer there. And, you know, I don't think it's sinful for the pain to remain. We don't remain in a state of mourning, but for there to be a sense of pain, a sense of loss to remain, I don't think that's a simple thing, because I think it corresponds to the depth of love that we have for people. We ought not to remain, however, in a state of mourning. You know, in some religions, women go around dressed in black, and there's this never-ending somberness to their lives. And I think that is not biblical. It's not healthy, because the Lord comforts. The Lord restores joy to his people, and we can find rest and peace in his sovereign will. And while we remain on earth, our view is to be that of service and walking with God and rejoicing in the Lord and sharing the truth with others. And so we do grieve, and we may remain with a sense of loss, but we don't mourn. We move on and live life to the glory of God. And so we have the death of Sarah, and we ought to think about death in our own experience. Well, the second thing I want to consider is the burial of Sarah. And we'll read together verse 3 to verse 20. And there's just a few brief comments on this. It won't be too long, I hope. Genesis 23, picking it up then at verse 3 to the end of the chapter. Then Abraham stood up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a foreigner and a visitor among you. Give me property for a burial place among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my Lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None of us will withhold from you his burial place that you may bury your dead. Then Abraham stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, If it is your wish that I bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and meet with Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he has, which is at the end of his field. Let him give it to me at the full price as property for a burial place among you. Now Ephron dwelt among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the presence of the sons of Heth, all who entered at the gate of his city, saying, No, my Lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed himself down before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, If you will give it, please hear me. I will give you money for the field. Take it from me, and I will bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, My Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? So bury your dead. And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out the silver for Ephron, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, currency of the merchants. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field, which were within all the surrounding borders, were deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went in at the gate of this city, of his city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded to Abraham by the sons of Heth as property for a burial place. So Abraham is concerned to bury his wife. As it stands, however, the land where he is living does not belong to him. Abraham is there as a kind of permanent guest. Let me just quickly summarize what we've read in verses 3-6. He requests land for the use of a burial chamber. And the Hittite elders agree to this. They are happy for him to have some land. In verses 7-11, Abraham asks them to inquire of a man called Ephron, who owned a good plot of land that Abraham wanted to use. Tell Ephron, I will pay him what the land is worth, says Abraham to the elders. Well, Ephron is present there amongst them, and he says to Abraham, I will give you a plot of land. I'll give you free of charge as a gift. See, they respect Abraham, and you can have the land. In verses 12-16, Abraham insists on paying for it. And Ephron tells him that the land is worth 400 shekels of silver. So Abraham weighs out the money. He agrees to pay it. He buys the land off Ephron. He receives title deeds to the land. And this is witnessed by the Hittite elders. They witness the transaction. In verses 17-20, Abraham takes permanent possession of this plot of land, and he buries his beloved wife, Sarah. So that's what takes place. There are some lessons I want to draw out of this this evening, some fairly brief lessons. There's four of them. The first one is this. Sarah's burial pointed to covenant promise. Sarah's burial pointed to the covenant promise. So at this point in time, this company of people, Abraham's family, the covenant community, they exist in the promised land as sojourners. We've already noted in previous sermons, Abraham wandered around everywhere. Abraham was always on the move. Now, we know when Isaac was born, he put down roots in the south in Beersheba, and he made a home for himself and his family. We're told that he planted trees. There's something symbolic in the planting of trees that pointed to the permanence that would exist for his descendants in this land of promise. But later in life, he's on the move again. We see now in our text when it comes to the death and burial of Sarah, he's gone back up north. And once more, his actions here symbolize the idea of ownership, anticipating the fact that this land ultimately belonged to God's people, his descendants. And how do we know that? Well, he buries the dead. And more of his family would be buried here. In fact, he would be buried here. Canaan is where the covenant people belong and where they would remain until the arrival of the true inheritance, the true land that was promised to them. What is that true land? It's a new heavens and a new earth. But this is all part of covenant fulfillment, and that must not be lost on us. The second lesson I want to draw from what we find here in Sarah's burial is that the dead do not belong with the living. Abraham speaks of removing Sarah out of his sight. This is the wife, the woman that he loves so much. But once life has gone, the body then feels the full effects of the curse and it begins to break down. It decomposes. There is a stench associated, of course, with death. And it's unnatural for the presence of the dead to remain among the living. And you know, there are cultures still in the world today where someone dies and there is actually a kind of burial chamber in the house where they're put into the living room floor and it's boarded up. But the stench of the deceased permeates through the whole of the house. And the living in the house, the family, are not to complain because that is to disrespect their loved one. But they live in the presence of the dead. And there are other cultures where the dead are taken and discarded in an open field and left to the elements, where the birds and wild animals will feast upon them and they decompose in the sun and the rain. And in a more sanitized way, it is popular for people to keep urns on the mantelpiece. And in the urn, Granddad is there, and Granddad is amongst the family. His ashes are there in the urn. And I don't know if this is your practice, but I do think it's not inappropriate to say that it is an unsavory thing to do, and we don't find it in the Bible. The dead have their place and the living have their place. The place of the dead in terms of the body is the earth, and the living live on the earth. The dead have their domain and the living have their domain, and Abraham must remove Sarah from his sight. She is to be buried, and I'll say more about this in a moment. The third thing I want to draw to your attention is that the body has significance. And we know the body has significance while we are alive. That's stating the obvious. Of course, our bodies are important, but the body is also important once we no longer have life. And I want you to notice that our text tells us that even in death, Sarah is referred to as Sarah. Abraham wept and mourned over Sarah. She had not just become to him a kind of carcass. She, in terms of her body, was still his wife. She was still Sarah. In terms of her physical entity, she was still Sarah, even though her soul had gone to be with the Lord. She is still Sarah. And he weeps over his wife. He weeps and mourns over Sarah, not a lifeless corpse, so to speak, but his beloved wife, who is called Sarah. Now, when the Lord Jesus died, devout disciples showed great care for his body. It's still Jesus, even though the soul had left. And I want us to see here that Abraham did not give Sarah's body to be consumed by animals. He didn't leave it in a field somewhere. She was not turned into fertilizer or compost. And I want you to also notice that he did not opt for cremation. I want to say here this evening, I do not believe cremation is a sin as such. And we are not commanded to bury the dead. And I know some of you have had cremations. And I'm not saying if a loved one has been cremated and you've been part of that process that you have committed a sin. I want to stress that. I'm not saying that anybody who cremates a loved one has committed a sin. But it must also be said we do not find the practice in the Bible. It is not practiced in the Bible. The only people who practiced cremation in the Bible were pagans. We know it was practiced amongst the Greeks and the Romans. It was never, ever practiced by God's people. They always, without exception, buried the dead. And it points us to the fact that the body is significant. It is important to God. And this terminology, you know, soul saving, God saves souls. Well, that's true. And that reference does appear once in scripture. But God really, technically speaking or theologically speaking, God doesn't save souls. God saves people. And that means body and soul. He saves people in their entirety. And God cares for the body just as he cares for our inner life. And we find here Abraham bought a plot, a permanent resting place for Sarah. He was offered some land for free, but that was not good enough for him. He was prepared to buy a plot, and so he was given the title deeds because that speaks of permanence. The plot of land was then legally his. Nobody could take it from him. And there the body of his dear wife could be laid to rest. He could care for her in death just as he had in life. People buy a plot of land today at a cemetery and the price is relative to how long they will keep the body in the ground. And you know, in metropolitan Sydney, you give it a time frame, 25 years to 99 years, and the body will be exhumed. It'll be taken out, it'll be put in a box, they'll do something with it because they want that much land for another burial. You can purchase a permanent plot for burial. You can do it, but it costs you a lot of money. And this is what secular society looks like. This is the outcome you see of a society that has moved away from Christian principles, where the body is precious, it's important. Now, bodies are a temple of the Holy Spirit if we are believers. And in modern secular society, the priority in death is cost and convenience. As if we are lacking land in this country of Australia. If you want your loved one to remain in the earth, they will charge you an arm and a leg to do it. Now, there are situations in which burial is not possible. Some people die in explosions, don't they? Some people die at sea, they drown and they're eaten by the sea creatures. Some people are eaten by animals, some people die in house fires. No matter how we die and whether or not a burial is possible, in a sense, in the purposes of God, it matters not when it comes to future resurrection. God will raise everyone's body back to life. Of that we can be certain, and Paul says that this is a mystery in 1 Corinthians 15. How will God do it? How will God take people out of the earth or people that have been in the sea and there's nothing left of them? How will it happen for people whose bodies have been caught up in an explosion? We don't know, but God will do it. God will rescue that person from within the elements somehow and form them again. So this issue does not affect future resurrection. However we die, whether we're cremated, it does not affect resurrection. Nevertheless, the biblical ideal in ordinary circumstances is that of burial. And it's something we need to think through in our own context. Now, if you opt for a cremation, that's your choice. And again, I stress you're not committing sin. And if you ask me to come and do the funeral, I will do it. No problem at all. But let us think through things biblically and let us not opt for easy options. Let us seek to follow the examples that we have in Scripture. God made the body, he made it good, and he saves us soul and body as complete people. He cares for the body. He cares for it in death. The death of the righteous is precious in his sight, and it ought to be precious to us as well. Well, the fourth point I want to make here as we think of Sarah's death and just some lessons. Fourthly, this physical world will be resurrected. This physical world will be resurrected. So the body returns to the earth from which it came. And just as the body awaits resurrection, so does the earth. And God's salvation is not only concerned with people. Of course it is concerned with people, but it's concerned with more than just people. God's salvation involves creation. God is savior of this physical universe. The whole of the created order has been affected by the curse of the fall, and the whole of the created order will be redeemed and raised to newness of life. Colossians 1:19 and 20. For it pleased the Father that in him all the fullness should dwell, and by him to reconcile all things to himself. By him, whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross. He will reconcile all things. And Romans chapter 8, 19 to 22. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Creation looks forward to a future deliverance. You go to a funeral and you watch someone lowered into the ground, and the minister inevitably will say something of their coming resurrection. This person awaits a coming resurrection, but it points us to a cosmic resurrection. The body dies and becomes one with the elements. Do you know biologically, physiologically, we are the same as everything else. We're no different physiologically than animals. The closest thing to us in terms of another living being is a pig. Physical wise, we're part of the created order. We're part of the elements like everything else. And our bodies return to the dust from which they were made, and we become one again with the dirt. And when Christ returns, he will extract us from the elements and form us again. And soul will be joined to our bodies. And then he will renew the earth. He will renew all the elements. He will renew the heavens. So the resurrection not only involves people, it involves the universe. And the burial of every person points us to that. A cosmic resurrection. And you know, it reminds us that we need to be careful that we don't form too great a distinction between the spiritual and the physical as though they are two entirely different entities. No, God made us physical beings with a soul. This world was made good, and God has a purpose for this world. He has a purpose for the universe. This world was designed to house us, and so it will do. It will do so when it has been perfected and when we have been perfected. This world will be restored, and so will we, soul and body. Well, in conclusion, to finish things off this morning, Abraham and Sarah, a unique couple, a unique family in the purposes of God, yet they lived ordinary lives. They were husband and wife, and they lived together with all of the ups and the downs that marriage brings, the good times and the tensions. There were children in the house. They had problems with Ishmael, and they had to struggle with that boy and his attitude to the point that he was removed from the household. They had the joy of Isaac. They lived together with their weaknesses and their strengths and their idiosyncrasies and all of those things. They were together for so long. The triumphs and the struggles of faith. And then it ended for them as it ends for everyone, with loss and bereavement. Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron. In a sense, it is so ordinary, yet it's so profound, and it's full of instruction for us. Now, 1 week ago, another famous cricketer died. Again, I was looking at the news on my app. Oh, wow. And, you know, it was like that with Shane Warne. Now Andrew Symons has died. And then in the days that followed, every day there were stories about his life and his achievements and his sporting abilities and all of those things, and people reflected and rejoiced in the life that he was given. Where is he now? What is he doing now? Because death is only the end in relation to this life. And those questions concerning that man are answered through other questions. What did he live for? What did he worship? Where is he now? Well, I am not the judge of men, and I am not prepared to say, because I don't know. But we know where Sarah went. We know what Sarah is doing. Hebrews 11 tells us that she died in faith. And so she is with her Lord because she lived a life of faith in him. And she is in that vast company of saints that are gathered before the throne, looking upon the face of the Lamb and worshiping him night and day. And she eagerly awaits the resurrection of her body, which has been entombed in Canaan for somewhere in the region of 4,000 years. There's nothing left of her physically, nothing. You cannot find Sarah's remains. But God knows where they are. God will piece together all of the elements that make her who she is, and her body awaits the general resurrection, where it will be joined together again with her soul, and she will be perfected. At present, Sarah exists in an unnatural state, but she will be made perfect. Where will you go? Where will I go? Those are the questions that we need to ask of ourselves. Where will the people go who we rub shoulders with, and our loved ones and our colleagues, the people that we do business with, where will they go? Let us not be complacent with regards to death. Let us not be those who sort of push it to the back of the mind as though it is something unsavory and something unhealthy that we ought not to think about. We ought to contemplate our demise and the demise of our loved ones. It is not a morbid thing to do. It is to face up to reality. 70, one brief hour. That's what we are given. Teach us to number our days, prayed Moses, that we might gain a heart of wisdom. In other words, teach us to live conscious of the brevity of life we don't have forever. Teach us, O Lord, to treasure the ordinary, everyday moments that we have with one another and our loved ones, and to appreciate the ordinary things in life. And teach us to be ambassadors for Christ, and to bring that word of reconciliation while today is today, because we may not have tomorrow. I just preached recently, didn't I, from 2 Corinthians, Paul's exhortation to the sinful Corinthians. Now is the time of salvation. Now is the day of salvation. Let us make use of the time that we have, because we will most surely die unless Christ returns first. We will go the way of Sarah and the way of all flesh, and that is a serious thing, and we ought to give it serious thought. May the Lord bless the ministry of his word to our hearts. Amen.